Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining me today on the Ask a Theologian podcast. I'm your host, Dave, and on this podcast, I talk with various theologians about theological topics, about their work, and mostly to bridge the gap between the theory of theology and our practical living, how we can make that useful to us in a very practical, public way. If you enjoy the podcast, it would be just great if you'd take a moment to give the podcast a review or a rating on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcast. It would be greatly appreciated. Today on our podcast, I had the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Stephen Felix Yeager. Dr. Stephen Felix Yeager is a professor at Life Pacific College in California. His specialties are worship and the church and the spirit. He's written numerous books, which you can access. But today on the program, we talked about ecclesiology. We talked about the theology of the church. What does that mean? Why is the church important? All of those kinds of things. So I hope today you get some insights and you'll get some valuable information as you listen to today's episode of Ask a Theologian. Awesome. There we go. We're recording. So glad to have you with us and talking about ecclesiology today. Now, Dr. Swoboda said you're the expert. Oh. So I asked him in our interview who he would recommend, and he didn't, I don't think it was a microsecond, and he said Stephen Fritz Yeager. So yeah. I went, okay, cool. So that's good. I appreciate you taking time to be with us today talking about ecclesiology. So one of the first questions I want to ask is why? Why does it matter what we believe about ecclesiology, about the church?
Yeah, that's a great question. And first of all, just thank you for having me. And AJ is a very generous fellow and brilliant. So yeah, so happy to be recommended by him. And he's absolutely one of my favorite theologians of all time. So yeah, let's talk about the why is ecclesiology important for the church? I think what you guys are doing as a church is phenomenal. Right. And I think more churches should model what you're doing. This is a really great avenue to go deeper and to understand theology, what it is, and not necessarily have to like jam pack it all on a Sunday morning or something. You know what I mean? So I think
totally.
That's great.
Totally. Yeah.
So ecclesiology is the study of the church. We have that root for ecclesia, which is church. It's for Spanish speakers out there. It's a
iglesia.
Iglesia. Yeah.
We're iglesia, roots
from
yeah.
that. So
that's right. You're Spanish speaking as well, aren't you?
I'm half Puerto Rican and half German, but I'm not like fluent and monolingual.
You don't speak German either.
It was my first language, okay. but when we moved to the States when I was six, I forgot most of it. And I was conversational in Spanish, but so I still got a little bit of both of them, but yeah, so definitely not comfortable enough to say more than a few sentences.
Okay. You know okay. I mean? We have quite a number of Spanish speaking people in the church. So yeah.
I think I just
froze for a second. No,
okay,
I'm
okay.
Yeah, I don't know
okay,
what
cool,
happened.
Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
It says,
all right.
It says it's not focused, but we're focused.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So, just to answer your question, why is it important for us studying the church? We can, I think, understand better as a community what is our nature, what is our purpose, and what is our mission. When we understand these things, we can function better as a church community.
Right.
And so, you know, famously that passage where Peter is with Jesus, and then Jesus says, "You are the rock that I'm going to build
right.
the church upon."
Yeah.
And that has given people different interpretations. The Catholics believe that, him being the first pope then, you know?
Yeah.
But Protestants have typically understood that to be what Peter did right before that was acknowledge that Jesus is Lord.
Right.
And so how we interpret this is that the proclamation of Jesus as Lord is the rock, is the foundation from which
absolutely.
Our church
yes,
is built upon.
Absolutely.
And so if we think about that, we can think of the nature of the church as a community of human beings assembled around, belonging to, and built on Christ and the proclamation of Jesus as the Christ.
Right.
And
right.
I think that speaks broadly. It speaks about, you know, a church that's visible to us here, but invisible
yes.
every time, you know, past, present, and future, you know, as we stand in front of the Lord. So
that's crazy when you mention it that way, that, you know, the church is you know, when we think actual church, it's past, present, future, invisible, mm-hmm. everywhere. It kind of strikes against the partisanship in church. I mean, I
totally, yeah. Yeah. Know, yeah. So that's a big heart of mine. You know, as I work on a lot of the worship I do and is towards reconciling individuals and people. And, you know, I'm Pentecostal. I come from that. But, I firmly believe that this Spirit being poured out on all flesh is this thing that, like, that unifies us all. The Spirit unifies us all. It's egalitarian spirit that just says that, you know, totally. Women and men, young and old, everybody, we're all together on this. The Spirit has anointed us all. And so it's really, really important for me. You know, the purpose of the church should then flow from its nature. And this is where we can see our purpose as a community that proclaims the apostolic message of Jesus.
Right.
And it mediates wholeness and unity among its members.
Right. That's what it should do.
It's what it should do. And this is huge. I mean, like when you are, you know, leading your congregation to understanding theology and stuff like that, the goal isn't just for head knowledge.
No.
But yeah, I mean, it's to implement an understanding of, oh, we're a community that is looking at mind, body, and soul, holistic formation.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. We tend to forget mind a lot. You know what I mean?
We forget mind. Yeah. Dr. Green said the same thing when we interviewed him on Christology. And I think the other thing, the holistic, we've tended, and, you know, I grew up Pentecostal. Pentecostal is my background. I'm still Pentecostal. But we've so often shifted to this dualism. You know, it's either secular or sacred. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't seen the holistic, or it's, you know, we argue about roles. And, you know, I was actually just listening to Amy Bird earlier today, and you know, just all that stuff, and you know, even the sense of, I know for me, the pride of being, you know, we've got it,
yeah,
and everybody else is just, you know, God's brought a correction along, so he brought Pentecostals.
But yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if we focus on one thing I love about our tradition is that there is a greater acknowledgement of our embodied presence in the world as we are worshipers. Yeah. And I think sometimes traditions miss that, like you pointed out, in the dualism, that where it's like, it's all about the spirit or the mind and we forget the body. But God created us spirited and embodied, and he called that good, very good.
Yeah.
He didn't call one good and one not. So
That's huge.
Yeah. And so in Jesus' ministry, look at how it's modeled. He didn't just preach. He fed and he healed and he helped the people in their bodies. And so, you know, if we're truly Christians, followers of Christ, I think we have to model what Jesus did himself. And you know, him as incarnated was not bad either, but it was literally that solidarity amongst humanity, just showing us that he loves us, he deeply enough to become one of us, to save us, and to just also model for us what
crazy
perfect humanity looks like, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, really what we're saying is that holistic ecclesiology then helps us, or keeps us from going, hey, well, you know, preaching to the lost is, you know, our purpose. Feeding the poor, well, that's just kind of secondary. Actually, they all go together.
Yeah,
you can't do one without the other. It's not a choice.
And I think that perfectly brings to, like, what is the mission of the church? Because our mission should flow out of our nature and purpose. And if we see ourselves as the people of God in this way, then we know that, like, our mission is multifaceted. You know, we are fundamentally called to make disciples, you know, the Great Commission, which is not simply converts.
Right.
Because we're supposed to baptize and teach people. We're supposed to, like, lead them into a whole way of life. And so I think sometimes some churches just, like, they want to tick off numbers. Like, oh, these people walk forward. Like, hey, that's not, I don't think that's what Jesus was after.
You know,
he wasn't afraid of losing his crowd.
Right.
Of nominal people. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so like,
true.
I mean, he literally, like, it's about disciples. It's about a lifelong commitment.
I think, not to interrupt you, but I think one of the things that I've kind of noticed a lot, I don't know why, but it just keeps popping up, is that the concept of a remnant in scripture is a lot stronger, even in the New Testament in relation to the church. And I think getting some clarity on the fact that not everybody's going to hear the message, and, you know, there's something to do, should give us a little bit of pause, you know, to consider how we direct our you know, our efforts and going like, hey, let's be clear about what we're teaching. Let's not just try to be gather a crowd.
Yeah, I mean, like, and if it's not about discipleship, I think we're shortchanging the gospel. If Jesus literally gave us himself fully, like all of himself,
yeah,
you know, we expect to package the gospel in a way that we're only requiring a little bit of people to come in. And that's not what God has ever called us to do. So it is a full commitment. It's an entire commitment. And I think, you know, oddly enough, that seems like it demands too much, but I think that's what people actually desire. You know what I mean? Like,
so how would you respond to somebody? I mean, this is the kind of thing as a pastor that I get. You know what? I spend too much time volunteering at the church. I'm burnt out and the church expects too much of me. Mm-hmm. How do we, you know, where does that kind of all fit? I mean, I realize that's multifaceted, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think burnout is a real thing and we need to be able to talk about like a healthy way of living and stuff like that. And this is where like churches can be adversely abusive in ways, maybe sometimes even not intentional.
Right.
It's where it's like, oh, my vision of what ministry needs to be is what you need to do. And you need to fall into that. And so I think it's less about like the individual actions of what you do in a church, like giving yourself over that, but like giving every aspect of your life over to God in discipleship. So like thinking about your finances, not as like, ooh, I earned this. This is my money. I can do with it what I want. But no, this is God's and I can steward what God has entrusted me of.
Absolutely.
It'll make us fundamentally more generous towards other people because we're not spending our money, we're spending God's, you know?
Right.
And it helps to situate us in community with each other, with God and with everybody in just a way that is equitable towards others. And then you're not thinking about, oh, that's the sacred and secular split. Here's my vocation, everything I do outside. Yeah. And then here's my church life. And so I just need to make sure that that I'm doing a lot in my church life, and then you get burned out here and it spills out over here. But no, make every aspect of your entire life as a disciple, not as a slave to the church,
right?
But as a disciple of Christ. And then you're going to see everything kind of just like be rightly situated.
Essentially. Yeah. I mean, I'm 100%. I mean, I'm a believer in local church. I'm a believer in all that, but you know, Jesus didn't say, take up your cross and follow the church. He actually said, take up your cross and follow me.
Exactly.
And I think the sense of that is take up your cross and let's together follow Jesus rather than, you know, a particular mission of a particular church, which is great. And we need to have it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you're a pastor. I mean, like I'm a theologian. It's not like we're anti-church. That makes no sense.
Right.
But just understanding the church as we are the church and it's a global mission. It's a universal mission. That we're called to make disciples. We're going to do it a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
But that being said, we're social beings that are brought up in a way that's not individualistic, but like in community. And so we need that local church community that we're a part of that can help shape us and form us, and that we help shape and form. That's part of our design as human beings of how God made us. So. All about the local church. I'm very committed in my local church.
Yeah, sure.
I've been a youth pastor and a worship pastor for many, many years. So it's not a knock on that, but it is a knock on, I think, the dualism that I think we try to make in our society where this is the, you know, Sunday is for this and then I'm going to burn out there and then the rest of it is secular.
So do you think that, like another thing that I would hear, and you probably would too, is, you know, people have... not necessarily deconstructed their faith, but they've left church.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe they didn't understand how important church was. And they'll say things like, you know what, I don't need to go to church because I'm the church wherever I am.
Right, right.
How would you respond to that?
I mean, I think, like I was just saying, it's a little bit of a denial of us being communal, like communally bound people. You know, of our, it's like kind of a denial of our anthropology, of how we should understand our human nature. If like, and they might say, oh, well, I'll find community in other places and other things like that. But are you finding community with the people that proclaim Christ as Lord?
Right.
And that are on mission with you to that? Because if that's the case, then you're going to church. That is what it is.
Sure.
But a lot of times what they'll say is, you know, they won't. They'll think about like, oh, I'm going to leave the church and then I'm going to privatize my faith.
Right.
I'm going to just like, maybe I'll read scripture every once in a while, do that.
Right.
And that does not go against
the whole idea of privatizing my faith is
that's the
anti-ecclesiology. Like, it's just not there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but great. if you're doing an alternate community of some sort, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like I've known people that have like, oh, we're gonna meet at a pub and do a church thing, but they're doing church, like they're just like doing it in an alternate community or a way or whatever. Yeah. There's still the everything that goes into church, where you're evangelizing, you're edifying each other, you're worshiping, you're looking at social concern, these actions that the church does together. They're doing it, but in an alternate way. Then you're doing church. That is what it is.
Yeah.
And so, but I think it's just the one of the significant parts of joining a local church. An alternate community is great in certain things, and you know, contexts are different. Sometimes, like in China, there's huge underground churches that you have to go to.
Totally.
Or you have to be really restricted in a state-sponsored church.
Yeah.
But like, whatever the context, whatever the environment, you know, finding that community where you can do those things, you can teach, edify, and grow with each other, worship God together, help others in our social concern, and then in evangelize the Great Commission, making disciples, then you're good to go. The nice thing about a local church is that when we're organized, we can pool our resources in a way
that
can go a lot farther than other places. And there's precedent of that in the New Testament. When they gathered together, they literally shared and pooled resources.
Right.
And we'll talk about it as our tithes or whatever like that we do.
Right.
But, but there's a lot of ministry that needs to be done, that if 1,000 of us pool resources together, we can make it happen. Mm-hmm. But if 50 of us do, we can't.
It's harder. So, yeah.
Right. And so that's just kind of one practical consequence of it.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's, you know, even in our particular setting, we have, you know, presently we have three locations, but they're quite distant from each other because of the geography of Canada. So it's 150 miles, 210 kilometers or so from where I am to our farthest one away. And there's a lot of times we're saying, hey, you know, would it be better if we were kind of on our own? But the reality is, by pooling our resources like that, our money, our bookkeeping, our legal stuff, we can do more.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that that's, you know, that's not necessarily everybody's situation, but in ours, that becomes a real thing.
It's a biblical model too. I mean, the disciples displayed a sharing economy between each other, where they did pool resources to do ministry. Like that's exactly what happened.
Right.
And so I think it's not something to be, it's something I think the church should model well to the rest of the world.
Right.
Because I think that will help us become a great witness of what God is calling us to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now one of the things, you know, again, just coming back off the, you know, the alternate gathering, or, you know, I am the church wherever I go. One of the things, and we haven't done this really well as Pentecostals historically, is this liturgy side of things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we would maybe even identify ourselves as non-liturgical, which would be fair, but we do hold to some sacraments.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and how do those, like, what's the point? You know, I mean, personally, I get a lot of times I get asked to do a wedding, and people want to do communion as part of the wedding. And I've actually had a policy that I said, no, I won't do that. Only because I've gone like, I think this is a church thing. I think this is intended to be a community thing, not just two people having this in front of everybody else. But I get flack on that. I'm not sure if it's good. What do you think about communion?
I'm a big fan. You know, like, no, I think you're definitely talking about a real situation, and I do talk about this quite a bit in my book, Renewal Worship.
Oh, okay, so cool. Little
and
plug.
Some great
little plug. Yeah. Renewal Worship. It's
little plug
on Amazon.
Little plug. Yeah, there you go. But also, friends of mine are great on this. Chris Green, who you mentioned before, writes really beautifully on communion. And my friend Andrew Ray Williams writes really beautifully on baptism, both from Pentecostal perspectives.
Wow.
So I think, so like, some Protestants make a distinction between a sacrament and an ordinance.
Okay.
So an ordinance is like the language of sacrament is like to be made saint-like and holy. Mm-hmm. So there is like an effective aspect of receiving grace there.
Right.
Like
another way of saying a means of grace. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. In kind of a historic Catholic setting. And so Protestants don't like the idea of grace being given through some kind of mediary thing.
Right.
So like they, you know, it's just by, you know, justification by faith alone, you know?
Right.
And so they'll use the words ordinance instead. And so an ordinance is just like, hey, those are the two things that Jesus ordered us to do. He said, go and make disciples, baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And he said, do this in remembrance of me. Those are the two literal rituals that Jesus verbally told the church to do.
Well, we have to add in one more. I mean, we don't practice it, but of course, foot washing. I mean, he says, do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some people will make that argument, especially Pentecostals, that foot washing is important like that too.
Yeah.
And so I think the way we should look at it, in some traditions that are more sacramental, they'll view these as like these ritual acts that we do to encounter this eschatological spirit, the spirit of God breaking into our present. We encounter that in communion. Right. We encounter that in baptism. And so like in communion, for example, we eat the flesh and drink the blood of Christ. Now, there's various understandings of what that means, but we know that there's something spiritually significant going on there.
Right.
And typically when you have like some kind of a covenantal framework in any sense, like you're saying like, this is a continual rite that I'm doing to reaffirm my dedication to Christ, but also there's something spiritually happening there where I'm connecting with God and I'm becoming, I'm forming and transforming into God's image by doing this ritual act.
Do you think that we typically downplay the, as Pentecostals, we downplay the spiritual part of it, and you know, we make it symbolic rather than spiritual?
Definitely. And that's not just from Pentecostalism. I think that's a lot of evangelicals. That's rooted all the way back from like Huldrych Zwingli from the Protestant, who had a kind of like that view. But one thing I think, and this is what I argue in Renewal Worship, and I think this would be good, is if one thing that Pentecostals do is we tend to see anything where we're meeting God as kind of this immediate inbreaking of the eschatological spirit. So like in worship, when we're singing and we've experienced and feel the presence of God, we imagine that like this isn't just like us getting goosebumps, but it's the Holy Spirit meeting us in this place.
Right. Right.
And so one of the reasons why I think Pentecostals downplay it is because the sacramental tradition will make that the main modes of experiencing God, whereas Pentecostals will say, no, we can experience God in any of these acts of worship, including communion and baptism.
Right.
And so it's like it's they make it a little more. And so a couple of historians, Sui Hong Lim I'm totally blanking on his name. He's awesome. he wrote Loving on Jesus and a few other ones, and he's a major historian of worship, and I'm totally blanking on his name right now. Lester Ruth. Sui Hong Lim, and Sui Hong is Canadian too. So
it's extra special. Yeah.
There you go. Well, they make the argument that Pentecostals view worship, musical worship, as sacramental.
Hmm.
And they say like, and this has influenced, and that's this Pentecostal understanding has influenced all of contemporary worship, really.
Absolutely.
And so the idea is, okay, if God is enthroned upon our praises, then our praises are actually this thing where God is met, where we are meeting God, like in this immediate way.
Sacrament. Yeah.
It's sacrament. But so Pentecostals broadly construed then, it's our musical worship, but it's any act of worship.
Right.
We're meeting God, and that includes communion and baptism. So I think what Pentecostals should do, I like that idea, and I think we should hang on to it and exploit that idea.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I think it's a brilliant idea. I think we need to start talking more specifically about communion in that lens too.
As an act of worship and a place where God meets us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And when we do that, then it's a lot more than just kind of the symbolic thing. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's funny, you know, just when we're talking, it feels like it's more appropriate to say, oh, here's a place where God meets us, instead of saying, you know, grace, you know, means of grace.
The channel of grace or means of grace. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of language would probably go well for a Pentecostal congregation too.
Yeah. That's really good. Now, we're talking a little bit about worship. You know, and of course, once we get into the worship, and that's an area where you've spent a lot of time studying and writing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, that's enough to destroy a church, you know, differencing opinions on worship. Yeah. And, you know, I was commenting to somebody the other day, that's a long, you know, when I started pastoring, we had hymn books, we had overhead projectors, we had the organ, we had all that. We don't have any of that anymore.
Yeah.
although we did bring back the doxology, so that's been kind of fun. But, you know, maybe talk a little bit more. I mean, you know, obviously sacrament is worship, but maybe talk a little bit more about worship in the context of church and, you know, the broad parameters of that.
Absolutely. Another little partial plug is the book Renewal Worship. The subtitle is A Theology of Pentecostal Doxology.
Oh, so you just, okay.
So you just mentioned that. And so like, and so, because I think it's our worship for Pentecostals specifically is a proclamation of our faith. It's such a hugely formative thing of how we understand God.
Oh,
and so,
totally.
Yeah. So I think it's a really appropriate way to think about it. But yeah, I define worship as turning our hearts towards God as a response to God's self-revelation. Right. I think what's important about that is there's an active and participatory component to this. First, God reveals himself to us, but then we respond to God. We're not just reflecting back to him as if we're some kind of robots or something.
Right.
But we're responding to God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just the way like our children respond to us parents as we like, you know, interact with them.
Right.
And so what I like about that is it begins and ends with God, and but it utilizes human and divine elements. Like it's okay. Relational. It's relational.
Yeah.
Worship to God is for God.
Right.
But God is relational in himself. And so in even us worshiping God, we are also rightly reorganized and put into, like in our relationships, in our relationship with God and relationship with each other. Like we get convicted in worship to go and reconcile with our neighbor.
We should.
And we're worshiping God, right?
Yeah, right.
And so, and this has to do with God's, I think, just relational and communal ontology. And like if we look at perichoresis, that God is relational in himself. And so,
So the Trinity and
Right. And so that's how I understand worship. And so anything in our service is that, though. So your sermon is that. Us reading scripture is that.
Right.
Us singing songs is a powerful form of this that we use, but it's not the only way.
So you wouldn't get too hung up on whether the songs we're singing are to God, encouraging us, statement. That one, right? Like, you know, we talk about it here, you know, should our songs be to God or should be the us about ourselves and, navel gazing? I mean, no,
I mean, that's a great question. And people argue this all the time, but so, you know, there's a context of both singing songs to God and about God in scripture, like singing praises of thanksgiving. Like we're essentially bragging about what God has done in our lives.
Right.
Like, God is awesome. Yeah. This is what he did. Yeah. And that's all throughout the Psalms, you know, enter his gates with thanksgiving in your hearts, enter his courts with praise. And then worship is like, and so these are people who distinguish between praise and worship, praise is being kind of this like about God and worship being to God.
Yeah.
And so, and then we're singing to God. Now, if we're singing about, if we're using, it depends on what we're talking about when we say we're singing about ourselves.
Right.
Because most of the time, I think people are just talking about using first person, you know, like to talk about God, like I need you or this, whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, have we read the Psalms? You know what I mean? Like this, it's like, it's all about that, you know?
Yeah. And I'm just thinking if we're going down the Psalms road, then we got lament.
We got lament.
Sorry. You know,
there's so much in there. And I think people are trying to diminish worship. Now, that being said, there is definitely something to be said about the heart of worship. What is going on?
Right.
Are you trying to glorify yourself and look like a rock star on stage?
Yeah.
If you're doing that, then you're doing something wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If like there's a song that I was just on a podcast talking about this, but Brandon Lake's Gratitude.
Okay.
You know that, you know, I really like Brandon Lake, and the song is beautifully written, but the bridge bothers me because he talks about, come on, my soul, don't you get shy on me. And like, he's like, he's like addressing his own soul. And there's a precedence of that in Psalms. So like, there's, it's not like it's nowhere.
Yeah.
But to me, that is very pastorally confusing.
Mm.
So you have like people who are singing their praises to God. I'm going to lift my hands and sing my praises to you. And then it's going to shift gears. And this is where people like really like get into it and like raise their hands and jump around and stuff.
Yeah.
And, but then you're singing to your soul and trying to get it hyped up. And so I think that is confusing to a congregant of like who is this worship for, and I think this speaks to that. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to demonize Brandon Lake. I think he's a good brother and like a great songwriter and all that kind of stuff.
Singing stuff,
for sure. But that song I would not do the bridge. Like when I tell my students, I'm like, you should not do the bridge or do something. I let them decide, but like,
yeah,
that's, but change the bridge or use a pastoral moment explaining what we're doing before we go into something, because it goes right into your thing of like, who's being worshiped.
Yeah.
Like that critique. And I think it's just like, it's a confusingly written song. Like, you know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Not, the intent, I don't think was wrong. But yeah, I think
I'm chuckling because every time I talk to a theologian, there's some song that shouldn't be in church. Part of it, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I mean, the fact is we do learn a lot of our theology through our worship too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I would say though, I'm usually an apologist for songs. Like I'm usually like, and so I don't think we shouldn't sing that song. But right. I do think we need to have wisdom in how we're doing it.
Right.
So like giving that pastoral moment. Knowing context of when things are and for the right thing,
sure.
I think that's very, very important. And because there's some songs where we'll sing, where it's God singing to us and like as part of it,
yeah.
And like you could do that in a church service if you like give a pastoral moment of what's happening, right. So that way your congregation is not confused. Like, all right, we're gonna sing this song. Let it be a prayer onto you. Like receive right. this as a prayer,
yeah.
You know, or something like that. And I've done that a bunch of times and. I think that's ultimately what it is. Like they're learning their theology, so we just need to make sure that it is clear, even though the point of worship is not theology per se.
No, right.
But it's you know, it's just get engaging.
But you can't worship without in some ways, you can't worship without a theological understanding.
Framework, yeah.
Yeah.
We're functioning under a framework, and we need to make sure that we're speaking into the congregant's theological understanding of everything. In an appropriate way. So like, so I'm going to say, I have not heard a heretical worship song. And this is kind of a bold statement, but so you have worship songs that like, you have your primary Christian beliefs and heresies basically reject one of those, you know what I'm saying? Like
Nicene Creed gone out the door.
Nicene Creed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I haven't heard a song that rejects anything from the Nicene Creed. I've seen a lot of differences in secondary beliefs.
Right.
You know, if they're talking substitutionary atonement, if we're talking more of a Pentecostal understanding of spiritual gifts,
right.
If we're talking about what, you know, like there's secondary disagreements.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen like heresy, like the primary.
Yeah. That's good to know. Yeah.
I'll give you an example though. This is a funny example, but a buddy of mine was a worship leader. He was at a youth conference and his friend was like the speaker.
Right.
Like the evangelist speaker guy. And he was just like, he was like getting the kids like all hyped and stuff. It was like a youth conference.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right, we're going to worship. Jesus is alive. And they're like, yeah. He's like, Jesus is alive. Yeah. And then they're like, Jesus never died. And then the kids were like, what? What the heck? And so like that right there is an example of heresy.
Yeah.
The next day he went on social media and he's like, I realized I said Jesus never died. I didn't mean that. I was kind of caught up in the moment. So I think it's just really funny. But
yeah,
you don't really hear that in worship songs.
No.
But as a pastor in a congregation from a particular place, you will have to make those pastoral decisions of what's right for your congregation.
Right. Yeah.
Without necessarily demonizing the other ones. And I think that's
exactly.
You know what I mean?
There's no bad, there's some that just aren't as fitting for our context.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. With, you know, talking about music and you mentioned Rockstar on stage and one of the things that you do write a lot about is that intersection between church and culture and, you know, can you just, you know, talk about that? I mean, one of the things again as Pentecostals is evangelicals in general, we've relegated some of the arts and artistic endeavors to, you know, that's icons, that's Roman Catholicism. But yet that's an important expression in the church, and there should be some intersection.
For sure. I think an important distinction that I think is beneficial for people is when we notice one of the differences here, and that is, what is the use of the art?
Mm.
And so this is not necessarily dualism, but like understanding its function.
Right.
So if an artwork is used for the purpose of worship,
right,
it's liturgical art.
Sure.
Then that might not be the thing that you go and engage the public discourse with.
Sure. Yeah.
Like it's for us. It's like for us and by us. And it's like, it's what we do to honor God.
Yeah.
Yet we can also make art that engages the public discourse. The public discourse is this open platform where we're all part of a large dialogue. We're all part of this conversation. Right. And so when we talk about what does hope mean in the world today, obviously us as Christians, we're going to like have that understanding of hope that's a biblically backed and eschatological understanding of hope that we're going to bring to a public discourse. It doesn't need to be overtly religious looking or like sometimes it gets like Christian kitsch, you know, like cheesy or whatever. It doesn't need to be all that, because you just need to like basically speak authentically about your own experience and then be open and willing to enter into that dialogue. That's the one thing. That's the public. Cause I do both. Yeah. I do art that's for the public, and then I do art in the church, but then like art in the church, totally different function. It's not art for art's sake. It's art for God's sake in worship. Right. And so you need to like conform your artistic endeavors to that. That's why like I write songs generally, and then I write songs, worship songs for the church. Right. Those worship songs, they got to be congregational. They got to be singable. They got to be all these things, because they're art that's in service.
Inside,
you know what I mean? And so I think if we can have that kind of distinction, I think a lot of the problems will ease. I think sometimes Christians think that they need to make their devotional art for the church and then put it out in the public and then almost like force it on people.
Right.
Where that's not the case. But you are, as a citizen of a pluralistic society, your voice is welcome and needed.
Right.
And so just make art, make it authentic, make it real. Don't hide things, don't sugarcoat things. Let it be real.
Yeah.
And then it will be a powerful public witness.
It can be, you know, for lack of a better, it can be spiritual art designed for the public space as opposed to designed for worship. Yeah.
My art, my visual art is deeply theological. Like I don't make it not that, but what I try to make it not is it's not preaching. It's not like, it's not like pushing my ideas onto people, but it's presenting my ideas into this discourse. Like, hey, let's consider this. You know what I mean?
I think if I remember right, C.S. Lewis always claimed that his Chronicles of Narnia were not written as a Christian literature, and that Aslan was not a type of Christ, even though we've made it that way. Mm. But he never intended, or he never wrote it with that in mind.
Which I know J.R.R. Tolkien said similar stuff about Lord of the Rings and stuff.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I know one of your books, if I remember, one of your books you read about the transformative theology or something of rock and roll.
Yeah.
So that's also coming from, that's almost like it's coming from the other side in.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's, I mean, the point there is that like punk rock and liberation theology are asking the same questions.
Wow.
They're exploring the same concepts.
Wow.
And so you have not only do you have inroads for dialogue.
Yeah.
But like you can actually speak authentically.
Yeah.
Wow. To the same things that punk rockers care about. When you care about liberation theology.
Whole other world here. That's great.
That's what it does. It looks at different genres and looks at like, what are these ultimate questions that we're asking? Yeah. And then what are and how does theology ask those same questions?
Wow.
You know? And that's a way to kind of like do that cultural engagement. You know, the Ramones, their biggest show, I want to say, was Brazil. It was definitely in South America.
Probably, yeah, yeah.
And so like, and just the idea that punk hit so big in South America in the 60s and 70s, like that speaks exactly to it, because they were the ones who were trying to have liberation from like oppressive governments. And then you got these crazy punk guys saying the same stuff. You know what I mean?
It resonated 100% with what was going on in the culture. Yeah.
It resonated. Yeah.
That's incredible. I think, you know, the more we get that understanding that the church belongs there. You know, it's not like I have to, it's a crazy thing. I remember when I was first pastoring as a youth pastor in a Pentecostal church, we had somebody who toured with a dance troupe. And I remember, you know, my wife and I having a conversation, it's too bad, you know, it's disappointing that there's no place for her in the church. You know, but I think we've just, you know, we've moved the line a bit. It's still got to go a long ways to find that. Hey, just a few minutes left. Chatting here. I'm just loving this conversation. I wish we could keep talking.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have another conversation another day. A couple things, but one, the big one, I think, is just the idea of church discipline. Mm. You know, that just seems like it's, I don't know who wants to go there. I mean, we've had so many high profile moral failures over the years. I mean, it's not new. We've had that for years, but at a local level, is church discipline still a thing? Is it important? How does it happen? You know, that kind of thing.
I mean, it was an important issue for Paul, you know what I mean? And so, and he said, you know, he gave us a little guidelines to it. Like usually Paul's a little bit obtruse about stuff, but not this. Yeah. He said, you know, like, you know, go to your brother and try to resolve, bring a couple of people, if not, then, you know, talk about, you know, having them leave the church or whatever. And that was specifically as they were engaging and bringing in Gentile traditions and stuff like that, and seeing how, like if they're bringing in crazy things like that. But there still is that precedence. I think what we are needing, one, is strong levels of accountability.
Mm.
And this is for our leaders. And one of the problems about, like, if you notice, a lot of these church failures happen in our tradition, in Pentecostal and, like, Baptist, evangelical traditions.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because there isn't a strong sense of governmental accountability.
Right.
It's a congregational thing where there's, like, a very charismatic leader. And then that church explodes. It gets huge. And then maybe they weren't ready for it. And then all the attacks that come in it, you know. They weren't ready for it, and then they made themselves susceptible to it.
Right.
Whereas if a tradition has a stronger sense of accountability with like elders or something like that, then that can be really helpful. So there's one thing is like, well, these churches can be dynamic. They can kind of grow and be uninhibited by other things, but at the same time, they can be susceptible to those kind of things. So accountability, I think, is really, really important in one way. And then in the other way, you know, we just need to think about, like, you know, in our one aspect of our current situation is like cancel culture.
Yeah, and of course.
There is something healthy about the fact of accountability. That's really important.
100%.
But we also are, as Christians, given the ministry of reconciliation.
Right.
And so finding ways to reconcile and bringing people back into the fold of a community, I think is really, really important for the church. And we need to model and witness that really well. That doesn't mean that they hold every same role, you know, like that doesn't mean that they do the same things that they were able to do before, you know, but like still like being able to be reconciled back to God and to each other, I think is huge. So
it seems like we don't do discipline well. And then when we do discipline, we don't do reconciliation well.
Exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah. You know, the Catholic Church does confessions, penance.
Yeah.
And I think there's something psychologically healthy about that we tend to miss sometimes in our things. And sometimes we have really good, you know, pastoral counseling available for our congregations, which is really great. And that kind of like meets that. But if you think about it, like, if you go to penance, the priest doesn't just forgive you outright. Like he says, hey, go pray this and go make things right with that person. And when you've done that, you come back and then you're forgiven.
I'm assuming that. I've never gone to confession, so I'm assuming that.
Me neither. My wife was grew up Catholic, which is little.
Okay.
And so, and my dad.
My track.
Many, many Hispanics were Catholic before they became, so that was my whole Puerto Rican side of the family.
Right.
Sure. But like, but the idea is like there's an actionable step to make things right. In other words, there is a level of accountability that's inbuilt into confession.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we need to find a way to re-implement without necessarily thinking of it as like, you know, the priest is the signatory for God and stuff like that. I don't think we need to adopt all that theology, but I think that the very important key of finding ways to bring accountability into our church living, I think, is really important.
So seeing discipline as restorative rather than punitive, because I think that's
100%
see discipline as punitive.
100%, and that's what confession does. Like you're confessing your sins, and then he's showing you ways to restore to make things right.
That's awesome. I mean, if there's any place that should do restoration right,
it's the church.
Yeah. It's in the church. Listen, sis, it's been unbelievably enjoyable. I've really enjoyed this. I would like to get, just before you go, if you've got for our listeners, a recommendation of a book or two that somebody could read on ecclesiology if they want to go a little deeper.
Yeah, so I have three, depending on where it is. So overall, there's a book called Exploring Ecclesiology by Brian Harper and Paul-Louis Metzger. I've used that in the classroom a lot. I think it's a really, really good overall introduction to like everything ecclesiology. Yeah. A good Pentecostal introduction would be Terry Cross's The People of God's Presence. It's a really
Terry
good
Cross,
one too.
Yeah, I've read that one. It's great. Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. And then finally, I would actually recommend my own book, the final plug.
We're going to recommend all your books.
there you go. But specifically, a lot of the themes that we talked about in this show up in Renewal Worship that came out with IVP Academic in 2022. And so yeah, that's what I would do.
Well, I'm totally into recommending your books. I mean, because Dr. Swoboda said you were the expert. So yeah.
I wouldn't go that far, but I appreciate that.
Listen, yeah. Dr. Fitzjager, it's been really great having you on the show. And I know our people are going to benefit so much from your insights. And hey, maybe we can do this again another time. It'd be a lot of fun.
Hey, I'm super happy to do it. I love what you guys are doing. I love that I'm able to be a part of this. And it was an honor to be able to talk to you about these very important things.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks. And we'll see you later.
See ya.
Hey, thanks for joining us on today's episode of Ask a Theologian. Once again, I hope that you got some practical insights for your world from our chat and on our show today. If you're enjoying our show, it would be really helpful to us if you gave us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you use to consume your podcasts. And if you have time, a written review would be even better. But either way, we hope you are enjoying the podcast. And if you've got questions, please send your questions. Who knows, maybe I'll be able to feature your question on a future episode of Ask a Theologian. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.